This Alternative Views program was made in June of 1981, before Namibia got its independence from South Africa.
When the Germans colonized it a century ago, they called it Southwest Africa, a name that has been maintained throughout the years of South Africa's illegal occupation. But after the international community placed the country under its wing, it was called Namibia. In the early days of colonization, the whites began to take over all the fertile land, moving the Africans to poor agricultural areas where survival is almost impossible.
Many Western countries invest here, but I prefer not to mention names. But they all invest here.
The economy of Namibia has always been based on the exploitation of cheap labor. For the same work, a white man earns 10 times as much as an African. And by law, the African can never be a supervisor. He is limited to manual labor. He gets a special contract, which, if broken, makes him liable to a prison term. He is given a special identification number, printed on a plastic band, which is then welded under the worker's wrist. He must wear it until his contract expires. 50,000 South African soldiers are permanently stationed in the country to protect the interest of the white minority at gunpoint. The peaceful protests organized by SWAPO have been ruthlessly broken up by the police on several occasions. Unarmed demonstrators were shot down and SWAPO leaders arrested, sent to prison in South Africa. The continued oppression forced the Namibians to abandon the peaceful approach and to resort to armed struggle as the only means to fight the illegal regime of South Africa.
The living conditions and the struggles of the people of Namibia are accented tonight on Alternative Views News Magazine.
There's another liberation struggle, national liberation struggle going on. Probably haven't heard about it very much because the media don't pay much attention to it. And that is what is going on in Namibia, formerly Southwest Africa. But the United States has great economic and political interests there, and a lot of things have been happening in the UN, which I think you'll want to keep yourself informed about, because you're going to hear more and more about Namibia in the future. But we're fortunate this evening on Alternative Views in having people who will be telling you a lot about the Namibian situation. And they brought with them a documentary, which is just very, very powerful, which shows you historically what has happened to the people in Namibia and South Africa's role there in repressing and exploiting the people and the region. It's really an eye-opener. We have Judy Jensen, who's the National Coordinator for the Dollars for Bullets campaign over on our far right, and our old friend Betty Ann Duke from the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. Judy Jensen, we're going to see that film about Namibia. Can you tell us a little bit about it before we start?
There are a couple of things I think that are important about the movie. One is it was made several years ago, so it really doesn't show the strength of the people's war in Namibia. It does fight for the leadership of SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, which is the vanguard of the people's struggle in Namibia, but it doesn't show what has happened in the last, say, 4 or 5 years in terms of building a people's war there to defeat South Africa. And the other thing that I think is important about the movie, it clearly shows the impact of white settler colonialism on the Namibian people, and the genocide of the Namibian people is very well documented, and those are things that we as people in this country, whose government has played a very active role in supporting South Africa and in contributing to the genocide of the Namibian people, must look at.
This country, I don't know what it would be like if it had been left to them solely and wholly. It would have been barren. There would have been nothing here. They have a great deal to be thankful for. But at the same time, I still admit that they should be given a square deal.
West coast of Africa lies a country as big as France and Great Britain combined, but with a total population of little more than 1 million. When the Germans colonized it a century ago, they called it Southwest Africa, a name that has been maintained throughout the years of South Africa's illegal occupation. But after the international community placed the country under its wing, it was called Namibia.
This is a name invented by the United Nations. We are still Southwest Africa, and we will remain Southwest Africa. We will never change our name.
I was born in 1919 in this house. My parents came from Germany, my father from Pomerania, my mother from the March of Brandenburg.
I arrived here in 1950 at Walvis Bay. For 4.5 years, I worked on a farm as a supervisor. Then I came to Swakopmund and bought a piece of land.
We had a very good relationship with our blacks. When we were kids, we used to play with them. We never had the feeling that they were black, but there was always the feeling that they were different. And when they ask us why we stay here, we can only say we love Southwest.
Life can be fun in Namibia, as long as you're a white. The white population controls most of Namibia's wealth, but only 1 out of 10 inhabitants is white. To protect their privileges, South Africa extended its own policy of apartheid throughout the country. Apartheid means the total separation of the races in every aspect of daily life. All this to keep intact an economic system which is based predominantly on the exploitation of cheap African labor. It deprives the African of his political rights and relegates him to the status of a second-class citizen. In the early days of colonization, the whites began to take over all the fertile land, moving the Africans to poor agricultural areas where survival is almost impossible. South Africa called these semi-desert regions homelands and assigned them arbitrarily to the different tribal groups. Since much of Namibia is desert, it has been said that wherever there is water is white man's land.
When we were still children, the white man came to our country, and with them, the difficult times began. We know what suffering means, because as the foreigners set up their regime here, they made us, who were born here, foreigners in our own land. We are herdsmen, but they prevented us from carrying on our trade. They forced us to live in areas we'd never seen before, and call them our homelands. We live in great fear. If the people of the world don't hear our cry, the whites in this country will destroy our people.
In
1966, the General Assembly of the United Nations declared the continued presence of South Africa in Namibia illegal and set up the Council for Namibia to administer the country. South Africa refused to recognize this authority, and today, 50,000 South African soldiers are permanently stationed in the country.
I think the whites in Namibia, unless they were supported by the whole strength of the South African regime, would not be able to stand for more than a month or two. They have no real organization, and the whole of their security really comes from the support that they get from the South African army and the police.
The South Africans have the most powerful army on the continent, an army equipped with the most sophisticated weaponry Western technology can provide. All this to protect the interest of the white minority at gunpoint.
I was born in Southwest. My father came to Southwest Africa in the German era. He fought with the German troops. My husband and I are in business together. We have many businesses, and we are also directors of Philips International in Southwest Africa.
Many Western countries invest here, but I prefer not to mention names. But they all invest here.
Why don't you want to mention names?
Because it is not opportune today to mention these names.
What can you offer to the investors?
Minerals, uranium, copper, lead, everything is here.
And diamonds. We ourselves invest here.
Namibia is one of the richest sources of gem diamonds in the world. Extracted by African labor, controlled by South African companies, the diamonds are transferred from here to dealers in Johannesburg, and with them go the enormous profits for their investors. Another priceless mineral, recently discovered, is uranium. The Rossing Mine is the largest open-pit mine in the world. Through the help of multinational corporations, The uranium mined here will be used by South Africa to develop its nuclear capacity. The economy of Namibia has always been based on the exploitation of cheap labor. For the same work, a white man earns 10 times as much as an African. And by law, the African can never be a supervisor. He is limited to manual labor. He gets a special contract, which, if broken, makes him liable to a prison term. He is given a special identification number printed on a plastic band, which is then welded under the worker's wrist. He must wear it until his contract expires. For many Africans, only a number to mark their graves. In the 60s, the Africans began to organize a political movement, SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization, a movement that became the largest political organization in the country. Their initial aim was to bring about change in Namibia through peaceful means.
If you explain and discuss and preach liberation, you are looked as a communist and a terrorist. That's as African are against the liberation, and therefore they don't like us. Not only like us, but they are even trying to eliminate us.
I'm a Namibian. I'm free from that racialistic tendencies. Yeah. Oh no, we're all suffering under the same system.
We are not allowed to talk to the white people in this country.
SWAPO is a legal organization.
Yes, it is. But you see, the government is trying to destroy SWAPO because SWAPO is the only powerful organization here. Mm. And now it means if they get SWAPO to be quiet, then they think they will win everything.
Ich fühle mich als eine Frau verantwortlich, um in alle.
I recognize myself as a human being created by God. As a woman, I can do something in politics. And as for Namibia, I can only say that I'll fight to make it happen one day.
The peaceful protests organized by SWAPO have been ruthlessly broken up by the police on several occasions. Unarmed demonstrators were shot down and SWAPO leaders arrested, sent to prison in South Africa. The continued oppression forced the Namibians to abandon the peaceful approach and to resort to armed struggle as the only means to fight the illegal regime of South Africa. Thank you.
15 rand, hab mir klare 15 rand, kann ich verkaufen. Rust 15 rand. Meneer, daar is bij eters recht gemaakt voor die café, jullie kan maar gaan eten alsjeblieft.
Except for its valuable minerals, the country's economy is based on farming and cattle. A long time ago, the African tribes came down from the north. They grew maize and kept cattle, brought their goats with them, and tended their long-horned oxen. All this has been taken over, successfully commercialized by the whites, who now export cattle to South Africa. Although Namibia's cattle number more than 2 million, an African seldom eats meat.
I'm hungry, Mrs.
When will you eat next?
This evening.
And what will you eat?
Bread and coffee. That's all.
That's all? Do you ever eat meat?
No, never.
Never?
Never.
Nee, kom. Mag ik niet? Nog niet scheepen. Kom.
The African who works for a white farmer receives his wages in food, a few bowls of flour, sugar, and fat. And with this, he has to feed himself and his family.
So, sugar? Yeah, take it. Oh, sugar, anyone's eye.
He goes home to a designated area, far enough away from his white employer, but close enough to be on call. The African to live on a diet of such poor quality that malnutrition and disease are widespread. The average life expectancy is 31 years for men, 33 for women. Half of the children do not reach the age of 5. For the family to survive, the men must leave their homes to join the huge army of migrant workers seeking employment in the areas reserved for whites. The journey south begins. In the city, he finds the same situation as in the mine or on the farm. The only available jobs are the ones rejected by whites. As part of the policy of apartheid, the Africans are kept in special all-male barracks outside the city, home for the migrant worker. An African may spend most of his married life away from his wife and children, who must remain in their designated homeland. Watched by police with guard dogs, the Africans are not allowed to receive visitors, nor are they allowed to leave their quarters after dark. Separated from their families, who are not permitted to join them, and crowded in groups of 10 in the same room, they live deprived of even the basic sanitation facilities. Like indentured slaves, they serve out their contracts.
Do you think that the rule of the whites will last forever?
We will fight for it.
And they do fight for it, in an everyday show of force to prevent any change in the system. All the repressive measures of South Africa's apartheid have been extended to Namibia. Only the African is required to carry a pass at all times, to produce a work permit whenever asked for it, to require official permission to move from his place of residence or change it. There are more than 100 laws to keep blacks in their place. If he breaks any of them, he is liable to detention, imprisonment, flogging, even torture. People disappear every day, and sometimes only coffins are returned.
I was put a rope around my neck, hanging over through the window. I was being told that, you see, you must listen well, you see, to the ghost. The ghosts are coming. You must listen. You see, you must breathe softly so that you can listen if the ghosts are speaking. I knew that they were trying to make me more afraid. When these two police came, you see, they started beating me. So they have beaten me about 24 hours. Around your face, your neck, your head, through your eyes. And I was bleeding, chased me around. And I was told that today they have got the right to go to kill me today.
My comrades actually were staying 9 months in a 6 months in a dark room, and the other 3 months it was in the light room. But it was so hard because he was trying to kill him three times, to kill himself because he couldn't get, it was too hard for him.
At 68, when I returned back home, I was shot by the South African police. Let's say if you are a man, you see, being touched to your, what you call private parts, being tortured with electric shocks, and you have to vomit. Sometimes you have to just faint for at least even 4 hours and so on. And I can tell you there's one man also who died just from all these shocks. His name is Jacob Monahotla. In fact, he's a South African, but we were together in prison.
Once sentenced, some political prisoners are sent thousands of miles away from Namibia to Robben Island Penitentiary, a prison off the coast of South Africa at Cape Town, under the watchful eye of the Pretoria government.
The black and the white can understand each other, but if South African government tried to take these bad laws away.
Yeah.
And well, we ourselves, we're trying to talk to the whites, yeah, to bring them in the way, in the right way, what the black want, but they refuse it, you see. Yeah. They still say, well, you are a kafir, well, you are not, you're not good indicated. Well, for what do you have to talk to the white people and say? And sometimes they say, well, this country belongs also to the white people. Some of them are born here. Well, we said, well, they can stay as long as they're staying under the black government, you see. That's what we want, because these countries belong to us.
Whatever they put some leaders in jail, that is not going to destroy the organization at all.
Are you not afraid to show your face on the film? And...
Not at all. I think we passed that point that we could be intimidated to anything like that. I think, and most Namibians have come to the decision or to the realization that we are fighting for freedom and we'll have to make a lot of sacrifices.
Late in 1977, the United Nations General Assembly passed resolutions condemning South Africa's illegal occupation of Namibia and giving support to the liberation struggle of the Namibian people led by SWAPO. The motion was carried by an overwhelming majority. But the Namibians are fully aware that the United Nations action alone cannot bring them freedom and independence. They meet in secret gatherings despite the tremendous risks to reaffirm their goal for a free Namibia.
One Namibia! One nation! We are the Namibia!
The struggle continues.
Betty Ann Duke, you're head of the, well, a member of the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee here in Austin and are involved in the Namibia situation, support SWAPO. And Judy Jensen is National Coordinator for Dollars for Bullets campaign. You're very deep into the situation, too. I assume that your organization brought Judy into Austin?
Yes, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee has been participating in the Dollars for Bullets campaign, which is a national campaign in support of SWAPO, the Southwest African People's Organization, and PLOM, the People's Liberation Army of Namibia.
So Dollars for Bullets, that sounds like a kind of a scary thing. Of course, it's a scary situation in Namibia, I guess, is it not, Judy?
Well, it's a matter of defeating genocide and winning national liberation. And the reason that we chose the title Dollars for Bullets is because we wanted to make an argument for people in this country to support the right of the Namibian people to wage a war, to free their country, and to end the genocide of their people. And we know from looking at what happened in Vietnam, from the success of the people's war in Angola, in Mozambique, and most recently in Zimbabwe, that people's war is a winning strategy, and it's a major tool that oppressed people have to win their liberation and to win self-determination. And that's why we chose the title Dollars for Bullets.
Well, let's bring things up to date from where the movie left off. For instance, let's talk first of all about the armed struggle. South Africa has a huge investment in arms there right now, do they not?
South Africa has, well, I've seen estimates from 70,000 to 100,000 troops in Namibia. And the Namibian people themselves represent less than a million. So you're talking about 1 to 7, 1 to 10 troops for every Namibian people. Plus, the United States has thousands of mercenaries now fighting with South Africa against the Namibian people, as well as mercenaries from reactionary governments all around the world.
Is the CIA supported, you suppose?
I think probably so. Betty Ann might could tell you a little bit more, because there's a strong connection between mercenaries, the recruitment of mercenaries, the Ku Klux Klan, and other organized forces of white supremacy.
What is that?
Well, we've seen, just especially in the last two or three weeks, a lot of activity, joint activity, really exposed on the part of the mercenaries and the Klan. this plot that was uncovered in New Orleans recently to invade and take over the island of Dominica, which showed that there were both mercenaries, Klansmen, ex-SWAT team instructors that were involved in this attempted coup. There have been reports in the press that at a number of the Klan training camps, the instructors have been mercenaries. We think that, you know, there's very close working relationship, and that what is happening is the building of an international white supremacist army. And yes, in response to the question about the CIA, I think since, you know, the first we knew of mercenary recruitment in this country, the CIA was very heavily involved. One of the main recruitment tools has been the Soldier of Fortune magazine. And the editor, Robert K. Brown, has had connections with the CIA for years. Several other staff members on the magazine have, you know, bragged about it in their own magazine of their association with the CIA. And now, since the mercenaries were able to hold their public conference in Missouri in the fall, which was heavily attended by police of all variety and by Klansmen, there's been a proliferation of mercenary magazines. Instead of just Soldier of Fortune that we had for years, we now have Combat, Gung Ho, Eagle, Pistolero, which is, they advertise the magazine for the mercenary here at home. And all of these are recruitment tools that are being used. And I think that the CIA is very heavily involved.
Well, let's take a look at the other side. What's the strength of SWAPO?
Well, I don't know in terms of numbers of troops. We do know that they're building a people's war. And I think the strength of that people's war was the force that brought the SWAPO's demand for comprehensive sanctions against South Africa to the Security Council in the United Nations the end of April and the 1st of May. And what we saw at the that debate that took place there was a unification of African nations that was unprecedented before. There were over 20 ministers, foreign ministers of African countries that came to the United Nations for this debate, and that was the most African ministers that had ever been at the UN at one time. And the entire world united behind SWAPO's demand for comprehensive sanctions, and not only supported SWAPO and the independence of Namibia, but labeled the United States, the Reagan administration, the Western powers, and South Africa as responsible for the war in Namibia. And if it hadn't been for the strength of the war in the country, that vote would not have happened in the Security Council.
Well, this vote was in reaction to violation of a UN resolution back in 1978 supporting an independent Namibia, was it not?
That's right. Since 78, UN Resolution 435 has been on the books, and South Africa has consistently refused, even though they agreed to that resolution, they've consistently refused to sign a ceasefire with SWAPO. And the resolution basically is a mandate for elections. And South Africa, along with the United States, is not interested in elections happening in Namibia, because if the elections happen, SWAPO will win. And they do not want another revolutionary African nation on the borders of South Africa, especially after what happened in Zimbabwe.
This is also parallel to the Vietnam War, in which the U.S. would not fulfill the Geneva Accords because they knew that the free elections, which were supposed to be held, would be won very handily by Ho Chi Minh. This is the same pattern over and over and over, isn't it? Both sides emphasize the strategic position of Namibia geographically as well as ideologically. Would you assess that for us?
When Namibia is free, and it will leave South Africa as the only white-dominated country in all southern Africa. And that definitely will have an impact, not only on the liberation struggle within Azania, South Africa itself, but also in terms of the worldwide system of imperialism, because the United States economically has always, you know, the history between imperialism and Africa is a 500-year history. And so when those nations win back their resources, their land, their labor, their destiny, it has a tremendous impact on defeating imperialism and white supremacy. And with with South Africa as the only remaining white-dominated country, well, it's just a matter of time before South Africa itself is won, you know, for African people. Its liberation will be won by African people.
And I wanted to interject one thing, Frank. You introduced the program by saying that we hadn't heard much about Namibia here in Austin, which is really true. It's rare that there's ever anything on the news about Namibia. But the debate that's been going on in the UN and the attention that's been focused on Namibia around the world has been central. I mean, it's been front page news in every major country in the world except here. And I think that, you know, it's really to our advantage to know what is going on there, to make an effort to find out what is going on there, because this is one of the major spots in the whole world that the whole system of imperialism is threatened, and one of the spots where they're getting much more vicious, you know, in attempting to hold on to what they have.
That's why the U.S. had to veto the sanctions. You know, it did not want the vote to happen, number one, the debate and the vote to happen. And when it finally happened, they were forced to veto it because they have to. They are allied with South Africa. They're both white settler colonies, so there is a strong alliance. And the United States had to veto it. But just to add something to what Betty Ann said, as a campaign, nationally we collected the signatures of over 10,000 people in this country in like a two-month period leading up to the time of the debate and the vote in the Security Council, from people in this country who supported SWAPO, supported independence for Namibia, and supported the armed struggle there. Now, this was not covered by the press. We called a press conference in New York at the time of the debate. It was not covered by the regular press in this country. It was covered by the black press, and it was covered by the international press. And people in China, in Vietnam, in Russia, in Cuba, around the world knew that people in this country took a stand against the United States and supported Namibia. And that's important for people in this country to know that what we do in support of SWAPO and the struggle of African people for liberation is significant. And we become part of a worldwide struggle of anti-imperialists. And it's important for us to know that and to join that struggle consequently.
The Reagan administration has made a tie-in of Namibia's situation with Angola, haven't they?
Yeah, most recently.
Yeah.
And just in the last two or three days, they are now trying to compromise what has already been agreed to around UN Resolution 435 and say that they will pressure South Africa to live up to its agreement, UN Resolution 435, if the Cuban troops are withdrawn from Angola and if the Angolan government shares its power with UNITA, which is a counter-revolutionary force that has been backed by the CIA, set up and backed for many years by the CIA.
Which has no popular support either.
Has no popular support, but the United States is now trying to, it's disregarding what has already been agreed to, what is supported by the African nations, and by putting forth this proposal is very arrogantly putting itself forward as the liberator of Namibia.
Well, I think another very significant thing is that South Africa has been using Namibia as a staging point for its forays into Angola. They have a lot of troops fighting in Angola. But also they've set up a puppet government there in Namibia, similar to the Zimbabwe situation, have they not?
Right. It's called the Democratic Turnhull Alliance, and it's a very insidious puppet government because not only is it a puppet, but it's headed by a white man, and it has broken the country up into 13 different Bantustans, really, and it's a way to divide Namibia into different principalities. And no, it has no credibility with the Namibian people. And one of the things the United States is trying to do now by putting forth all these other solutions, while at the same time it's sending more mercenaries and more arms for South Africa to fight against the Namibian people, is to bide time, hoping that the DTA will gain some credibility in the country. And so then they can say, well, there's this, you know, there's this other solution, and that's the solution, you know.
Another interesting thing that's happened recently is with the French elections, François Mitterrand has indicated that he is in support of Namibia and against South Africa, whereas the previous government supported, well, they were one of the vetoing forces in the UN. So it looks like France may switch sides. I wonder what effect that would have.
I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. I have no idea what France is going to do. I mean, they pretty much put themselves out there when they vetoed the sanctions.
Well, let's talk about what SWAPO has in mind. About 2.5 years ago, on alternative views, as a matter of fact, it was our first program, we actually read the plans of the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Nobody even heard or cared about the Sandinistas at the time, but in the alternative press, we found actually what they stood for and what they wanted to have. And we have a statement here by SWAPO of what they want to do, and it sounds fairly similar, of things for the people, education, health, taking over of the land, providing for better facilities for the people. It doesn't sound all that wild, you know. It sounds like things that normal human beings who care about themselves and their fellow people would want for themselves.
No, I think that's true. From all I've read and heard them say themselves, they plan to set up a socialist society, you know, and they do plan to deal with the basic needs of the people who live there. And one of the things that they have that I think is very significant, and it's part of their structure now, is a women's council. And I think they understand, like other socialist governments and revolutionary forces around the world, that women's liberation is key to building a socialist society, that you cannot liberate a country and have half of the people oppressed. And they are very aware of that. And consequently, the Namibian women are participating in the People's War. And if their participation is something that they fight for themselves, they will make a very significant contribution to not only the liberation of their country, but also the development of a free and just and non-racist society in Namibia.
Let me ask you this. In one of the provisions of SWAPO's plans for the country, they say that they want to eliminate the tribal and feudal mentalities in the country, particularly the social and natural pertaining to social and natural phenomena. Are they indicating that they may be trouble in putting a socialist system over a feudal and tribal organization which they have in the country now? I'm thinking kind of, although it's not parallel at all, the problems which occurred in Afghanistan, where they tried to graft a communist or socialist system, enforce it on people who were very, very feudal and weren't willing to accept it at all. Is there any possibility of this in Namibia?
I don't know. I honestly could not answer that.
Or is the fact that they've been subjected to imperialism for so long made them pretty much one against their oppressors?
Well, many times in national liberation struggles, different, people with different languages, different customs, or tribes are forged together as a national liberation struggle. In Guinea-Bissau, for example, there were 22 different languages that were spoken, and those people were forged together in a struggle to free their country from the Portuguese. And I think that's true in many liberation struggles. I don't know so much about the breakdown within the Namibian people, but if they're building a people's war, then that means they are, you know, uniting all people as around their common enemy, and that's a powerful force.
Go ahead.
I think that this is something that we've seen in a number of the African countries. I'm thinking of Zimbabwe, where there was a big effort to respect the heritage of people from different parts of the country who may have had different customs, but still to unite the people of the country into one people, and so that they could wage a genuine struggle against the white settlers who were then in power. And I think that we are seeing the same thing here, and it's a real necessary thing, because one of the main ways that the colonial powers have been able to continue to dominate is by exploiting the tribal differences that do exist. And so it's very necessary for the liberation forces to really create an understanding of the common unity that the people who were indigenous to that country do have.
Yeah, there was the first emotional reaction I had when I was reviewing a lot of this material again and looking at the movie was, My God, is the United States going through this all over again? Haven't they learned anything from Vietnam, from Nicaragua, from all the other wars of liberation that have been successful? And like you say, they're going to be successful. And I thought, well, you know, there must be some real reason. So I started thinking, first of all, while all this is going on, the multinational corporations and all, and the settlers there, the white settlers, are still getting their profits, right? They also are showing other countries that where the people might be wanting to struggle in the same way, that if they do, it's going to be at a terrible, terrible price. And then maybe the key thing is the fact that if they can stretch it out, cause horrible death, destruction in the country, that when they have to rebuild, they're going to need money, just like in Nicaragua. And where can they go to get money? Soviet Union can't provide it. They're not that rich. They're already providing money for Cuba. They've got to go to the same old Rockefeller, Morgan banks and their buddies in the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So the greater the Holocaust they can create, the better it's going to be for them later. I wonder if that's really what they have in their mind.
Well, I think it's a lot of what they have in their mind to some extent. I mean, they are, the profit rate in Namibia is one of the highest in the world. And there are 500 U.S. multinational corporations in Namibia. They're also, by ripping off the uranium and the other minerals that are there, they're affecting the future of Namibia, because they're doing it at such a rate that it will affect the future of Namibia. And I think the other aspect of it is about white settler colonialism, because a defeat for South Africa is a defeat for white settler colonialism. It's a defeat for the system of white supremacy. And the United States has built itself on the ideology of white supremacy. So on many different levels, they do not want to lose in Namibia. And I'm glad you brought this up again, because like you say, most people in this country have never heard of Namibia. But the fact that the United States has thousands of mercenaries in Namibia, the U.S. is already at war with Namibia. And by putting mercenaries there, they're putting a reliable, highly trained, professional force that fights for white power. Very well equipped. They cannot send an army that's drafted into Namibia like they did into Vietnam, because when black and third world people go into a colonized country, they say, why are we fighting these people? Just like they did in Vietnam. They cannot send black people from this country to fight Africa. So they have to send mercenaries. So we are at war with Namibia.
In addition to raising money for the liberation struggle there, we think that there are concrete things that we can do here in this country to restrict the United States' ability to wage war against Namibia. And so we have a commitment to shut down the Klan and mercenary training camps, and to expose and stop the mercenary recruitment. And you know, a lot of it is going on right here in Texas. This Cobray School, which is an internationally known school for mercenary training, used to operate in Georgia, has just moved to Dallas, because the political climate in Texas is so favorable for it. This was a school that started by mercenary Mitchell Werbel. And they say now that they are not going to knowingly train anyone who's a mercenary or in the Klan, but that what they are going to do is train corporate bodyguards, anti-assassins, anti-terrorists. And any ordinary citizen can pay $3,000 and take this, what they call, survival training course. And so this school is now here in Texas, along with the Klan training camps that we know about down at Anahuac, Camp Puller, and others that are operating in East Texas, and one up by Fort Worth. And so the effort that we can make here, I think, to you know, to expose and stop this recruitment and training can have a very real effect in aiding the liberation struggle there, and also in aiding liberation struggles that are going on in this country, because those forces are also have as their purpose to restrict those struggles. And I think that it's no clearer anywhere than it is in Atlanta, where there are black children and now black men being killed. Outside of Atlanta, there is a Klan training camp operating. Inside Atlanta, the police are disarming black people who are patrolling and defending their neighborhoods. And so, you know, we can see the unity of the white supremacist forces that operate both in Namibia and here in the United States. And people in this country, particularly white people, have a responsibility to stop this.
There was a series of articles in the New York Times and the Village Voice about South Africa that indicate that the apartheid regime is getting new opponents there from business and new right conservatives in the United States who are beginning to protest against the apartheid policies. In the New York Times, they report that businesses, U.S. multinational corporations, are beginning to act against apartheid, that 120 American companies that operate in South Africa agreed to press for broad changes in South African society, including the repeal of all apartheid laws. That this agreement came in the form of an addition to the Sullivan Principles, which is a code of ethics devised by Reverend Leon Sullivan of Philadelphia, such that American corporations that operate in South Africa would respect the labor rights of blacks, giving them equal wages as whites, better working conditions, etc. But now they've extended this to involve civil rights in the broader sense and to oppose all apartheid policies. And 120 corporations have signed this. Moreover, some of the most significant new right congressional politicians, such as Newt Gingrich of Georgia, has also sent a letter to the South African government saying that they oppose apartheid policies, that they require or request a modification of the apartheid policies, giving more rights to the blacks. And moreover, they threatened that if the South African government does not end their apartheid policies, that they will propose economic sanctions against the South African government and other diplomatic sanctions against the South Africans, which is quite a change that not only are radical and progressive opponents of apartheid protesting against the South African government, but now some of the business and new right conservative interests are doing so also. However, an article in The Guardian puts this all in perspective, showing how it's really U.S. corporations and the Reagan administration that has been the strongest support economically and politically of the apartheid government in South Africa, pointing out that 350 U.S. corporations have operations in South Africa, and 6,000 U.S. corporations do some form of business there, and that over the last 5 years, the United States have been South Africa's leading trade partner, in which U.S. companies supply about 15% of the imports to South Africa and absorb about 8% of its exports. And moreover, they point out how under the Reagan administration, certain restraints and controls against exporting high-tech and computers to South Africa have been lifted by the Reagan administration, which has also allowed military exports to that country. So it's really the U.S. economy and policies that have been the major support of the apartheid government, so that if some of the corporations and politicians are beginning to question this, this raises some serious questions for the South Africans.
And that's Alternative Views for this evening. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any compliments, hey, we'll take them, or any kind of comments, we'd be glad to hear from you. Please get a hold of us at that address. If you'd like to see any previous Alternative Views programs repeated, you can call Austin Community Television or write to us at this address here. We'll be glad to arrange it for you. Good night.